queer in a small town can be a difficult experience. As a budding gay youth in Hayes, Kansas during the 90s, it was difficult to find people I could relate to, let alone role models. What little information and examples of my impending queer life I did find usually left me feeling even more isolated in my Midwestern home. Unable to identify with the drag queens, leather daddies, and raging AIDS activist stereotypes presented in the media, I retreated to an identity of my own. I'd always loved music, and there was gay music at the time, but it was nothing I could relate to. George Michael and Elton John had yet to be dragged out of the closet. The music of newly out lesbian artists such as Katie Lang and Melissa Etheridge I found unrelatable due to their vague lyrics and half-assed queer personas aimed at keeping them on the top 40 charts. It seemed the only music being made by artists who were out, like Bronski Beat, the Pet Shop Boys, and Erasure, was dance music aimed at the gay club scene. This left me disenchanted and confused. I wanted to rock, and if this was gay music, then I wasn't interested. I started writing songs on acoustic guitar, performing in coffee shops, and later establishing my own band, Lemming, a post-Nirvana angry boy grunge act whose music was loud, defiant, and full of profanity. Due to my immature vocal stylings and rather unintelligible lyrics, I found that I could occasionally throw in male pronouns, sing about jacking off, my only sexual outlet usually, and trash on the local closet cases that had broke my out and proud heart. We were popular in a city whose music scene consisted of 6 original bands, 3 actually being able to play their instruments, and no one really ever noticed all the gay subtext I was throwing in. As fun as it was to have frat boys moshing to songs about cruising Buffalo Park, I still felt like a traitor of sorts. I figured that if they knew what the songs were really about, I'd get my ass kicked. It was on an out-of-town trip with Lemming that I ran across a CD that would change the way I thought about my music and what was possible if you had enough balls to be who you are. That CD was Pile Up by San Francisco's openly queer pop-punk geniuses Pansy Division, and I had never heard anything like it before. This is Lawrence singer-songwriter Charles S. McVeigh, and today I'll be interviewing Pansy Division's frontman and founder, John Ginoli. How are you doing, John?
Very well, thanks.
Excellent. I know you're on a book tour now, and how is that going for you?
For the most part, pretty well.
Good, good. You're traveling, I believe, driving yourself around old school style, yes?
I am. I started in San Francisco, went around California, went up to the Northwest, and now I'm in New England, so I've still got some miles ahead of me before I get to Lawrence.
Yeah, sounds like it. But you do have quite a trek. How long is the tour, actually?
Days, I think it's like 35 days, then I'm home for about a week, and then I have another three and a half weeks.
So it's kind of a fairly old school style arrangement for you then.
Yeah, it's kind of like what Pansy Division used to, the tours we used to do when we had unlimited time to do them.
Mm-hmm.
But now I just have the unlimited time. So it's nice. I was in Providence, Rhode Island last night, and I ran into some people I hadn't seen in over a decade, which is the last time we played there. So I wish I was still able to travel all the time to play music, but unfortunately there is reality. But it's nice to have the book tour be an opportunity to do that.
Yeah, sure, and it's always nice to see old friends in town.
Yeah.
All right. Well, you know, I've been reading through the book Deflowered, which is on Cleus Press, and I have enjoyed it quite thoroughly. So why don't you tell us a bit about the background or your background before starting Pansy Division? We know you were a Midwestern boy in Illinois.
Yeah.
What was it like growing up in America's heartland queer?
I grew up in Peoria, Illinois. I went to University of Illinois in Champaign-Urbana. Graduated from there, had my band really after I got out of school, and had my first band. And then that band had made a few albums, a small label. Broke up, I moved to the West Coast, and that's where I formed Pansy Division a couple of years after I'd gotten to San Francisco, even though I'd had the idea to form the band when I was still living in Illinois, but it just seemed really preposterous to try to have an out gay band that was singing really blatantly about sex and sexuality. So it took me a while before I could envision an audience for it and had put together some songs to actually make it a reality.
Well, in the book you discuss, you felt like there was a pull between your music life and your gay life.
Yeah, they didn't overlap too much when I was in Illinois. I mean, I was very involved in the music scene in my college town. I was on my college radio station. I was the music director by the time I was a senior. I had written about music for a college paper and some other papers, other places. And after I got out of school, I also started booking shows in various clubs. So I was totally accepted within the music scene. But I almost never ran into gay people in that scene. And I was always falling in love with these people who I thought were cute and had lots in common with and could be friends with pretty easily, but they just weren't gay. And so I got kind of fed up with that, and I finally decided that I needed to leave, because I really had not intended on leaving the Midwest. I thought I might move to a bigger city, like to Chicago or Minneapolis or something. But I didn't, and I decided I'd had enough of winter as well. So I said, well, you know, I don't have to live in a place where it gets to 25 below in the winter, and it gets so cold that the tires on my car go flat. So I was combining that, being tired of the weather, and my desire to live in a more gay-friendly place.
Sure. So you went out to L.A. then.
Went to L.A., didn't last there too long, had a job, music-oriented, music biz-oriented job working for a record distributor. That company folded, and I ended up getting hired to do something similar in San Francisco. And I was there about a year and a half before I really had the impetus to do the band. But I think it could have formed elsewhere, but not so early. I think it would have taken me a while to get around to it somewhere else. But being there, I could envision an audience for it. But I couldn't envision an audience outside of San Francisco. So I thought, I'm going to have a local band. We'll be popular, and that'll probably be about it.
I don't like macho, put it away. Doesn't appeal to me, straight or gay. But I know a boy who catches my eye. He don't act tough, why should he try? He's a fan. In a black leather jacket, he's a gem. In a black leather jacket, he's a fan. In a black leather jacket, and I wanna take him home with me. With his long, long hair and pouty lips, cute little butt and sexy hips, the way he he's a fan. In a black leather jacket, he's a gem. In a black leather jacket, he's a fan.
Now that more people are out, especially at younger ages, I think there's less baggage in terms of what people are expected to be if they decide that they're gay. There are more alternatives to the kinds of strictures that I found, where you were supposed to be, if you're gay, you're supposed to be in a certain kind of music, you're supposed to, you know, dress a certain way. I mean, there's still norms, but I think now it's easier to be happy and not have to fit into those narrow strictures.
Sure. So tell us a little bit about how Pansy Division started and what maybe were some of your goals initially. You mentioned you wanted to be, or you assumed you could be probably popular locally, but...
Yeah. I was really just trying to bridge the gap between having a music life and a gay life. And I had, in the band I'd had before, I had been out, but I really didn't want to sing about it directly in lyrics because I was the only gay guy in the band, only gay person in the band, and I was the main singer and songwriter, and I didn't feel like, I mean, if I was going to sing about gay people specifically in that band, it would have meant to me, I think to my bandmates, that, okay, we're not a group. Now we're backing John up because he's got a different agenda than we do.
Sure, sure. So tell us about finding Chris.
I felt like I couldn't really be as out and open as popular as possible back during that time. So that was one of the impetus that I had for forming a gay band. Then I wouldn't have to explain.
Sure.
To my bandmates, they would get it.
Well, and I know from having experiences as being a gay songwriter, too, that the bulk of the musicians I've worked with have been straight as well. And so it's you know, hard to do something honestly without people thinking you might have an agenda that isn't necessarily true. So you started out in San Francisco doing some demos while you were working at Ref Trade. That's correct? And so tell us a little bit about how you started the band version of Pansy Division. You met Chris?
After playing a few months solo, because I thought, I mean, even in San Francisco, I thought, I'm not going to find people who are going to want to play these songs that are as blunt as I want to be. But after doing pretty well, actually, on my own as Pansy Division, I realized, and other people advised me, that I should really get a band. So we did, and I found Chris Freeman to play bass. But the drummer situation was very hard to fill. I mean, I knew people in bands who were not gay, who also had drummer problems. It's not as common a skill as a guitar player. So we had a lot of drummers trying to find the right one, and also because we were borrowing people from other bands who couldn't really join our band but liked our idea and wanted to help us out.
Well, did you feel, or why did you feel that it was important to, I know Pansy Division's songs are pop punk, and you've addressed this before, that there's a specific reason why you chose that kind of medium to try to portray gay life in a more positive manner, or...
I mean the pop punk thing is because I thought I wanted catchy stuff that would be really simple and direct. So I didn't want the messages of the songs to get lost in the music. I wanted to make blunt and forceful songs or lyrics. So I thought, well, that's how the music's got to be too. But it's got to be uncluttered. It's got to be, for lack of a better word, straightforward. And that was the though we've evolved over the years, that's still kind of the basis for the band.
Sure. Initially, you were labeled as queercore, and there were some other queercore bands forming around that time, such as like Extra Fancy and Limp Wrist.
That was a tag that I can't remember when we started hearing it, but
well, and it was actually
I'd written about music, you know, since I was in high school. And I would always throw labels on bands that I was writing about, saying, oh, yeah, this band is one of those blah, blah, blah bands. Well, suddenly I was in the opposite position where people were writing about me using words that I had never used to describe my band. So that was an interesting experience. But, I mean, I say we're a gay rock band. I don't really usually even say that we're a gay punk band. If you're asking me what we are, because that's how I see it. But it's definitely, punk is definitely an element of it, but I think a lot of punk rock is really boring. So I want it to be punk, but also be something else to make it interesting. So it's kind of pop, it's sort of 60s oriented. The new album's sort of 70s sounding a little bit in places. But that was... But that was the idea, was to, keep going. I think I was going somewhere with this. I can't remember now.
Well, I mean, something that I think was an interesting dynamic between your band and the bands that I had just mentioned was that Pansy Division's songs are fun, and they have kind of a positive attitude about it, as opposed to, you know, the more bitchy punk rock mentality or anti-establishment type of mentality as some of the other, you know, quote-unquote queercore acts at the time did.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
And I was wondering what your motivation behind that was, if that was a specific thing that you had intended to do, or if that's just who you are.
Actually, yes. I mean you start out with ideas about how you want to do things, and a lot of times, you know, you change your mind or you know, you just evolve out of that. But with us, we didn't want to do gay propaganda songs, but we did want to present. I mean, this is back during the height of the AIDS crisis, and Jesse Helms and all those people. So, you know, there was such a negativity associated with being gay. You know, you're going to die, you're going to be attacked. And we wanted to say, no, that is not necessarily true. And using our own lives as examples, we wanted to show that, yes, you can be gay and be happy, and, you know, whatever your sexual orientation, you're still going to have problems. But to at least say, you know, you can be gay and be a regular person or a normal person or the biggest freak you want to be, but just you can be. And we tried to celebrate sexuality because there's a lot of sexuality in the media, but it's all kind of this fake titillation stuff. Mm. And we thought, let's just deliver it. Let's be upfront and bold and, you know, celebrate it. But also, you know, we're not just going to celebrate sex. We're going to celebrate fucking like bunnies. So let's just, you know, take advantage of the fact that we've got free speech and not hold back. Let's be uncensored and let's take advantage of the fact that in the past we couldn't have said these things. By the early 90s, things had evolved enough that we felt like we could be a queer rock band without thinking that it would be that dangerous. Sure. Although we probably would have done it anyway if we really felt, you know, if we'd wanted to, you know, change the climate more. I mean, I think we did help change the climate, but we came along at a really appropriate moment for a band like us to sort of waltz in and say, all right, the time is now.
Well, I remember
played in society at large.
Well,
I remember too, even though Pansy Division songs are funny and positive, there's a lot of anger behind them. It doesn't come out in the music too much just because I don't think that the kind of songs we wanted to do included that, but it's the undercurrent, you know, where it was very defiant.
Sure, and I mean, I was taken back quite a bit by the first time I heard Pansy Division with some of your bluntness and the things you discussed. I remember being quite shocked by Ring of Joy, for instance, and playing that for my friends.
That probably is the most propagandistic song we ever wrote. It's at one end of the spectrum. But we were just trying to sing about things that hadn't been sung about. So let's sing about your asshole in a positive way.
This before we take off our clothes before we're in the door. 8 hours of work is especially tough when 3 times a day is barely enough. I got the carrot, you got the stick. You start to nibble, I start to lick, and we get our bodies all hot and sweaty and runny, and then we fuck like bunnies.
And we had a few labels interested at a certain point, so we had to make a decision, and we ended up going with Lookout in part because they were ready to move to put the records out right away. And that turned out to be very beneficial because Green Day had been on Lookout, and if we hadn't been on the same label as them, I don't know if they ever would have heard us, or at least heard us as soon as they did, because that connection allowed us for them to know about us when they needed an opening band for their tour.
Sure.
And they were just getting big.
And Green Day became a great asset for you. In fact, they pretty much,
tremendous.
They boosted your career quite a bit and very quickly.
I mean, it really was helpful for both bands because they were entering the mainstream. A lot of people were saying, what is this band about? And having Pansy Division as an opening band was a big statement about what kind of people they were and how they saw the world and how they used their bully pulpit. That came with their sudden fame. That was a big deal for us, obviously, because we got exposed to all these people who never would have heard us otherwise. I mean, we did not expect to be playing music for teenagers, even though when our first album came out, we started getting letters from them. But, you know, even at the time that we think, yeah, good, we're gonna get to make albums, more people are gonna hear us than we, you know, had ever dreamed of. There was still the idea that, well, it's going to be for us people in our 20s and 30s or older maybe, but not kids. It wasn't aimed for kids. It was aimed for queers who were, you know, gay rockers who were disaffected by gay culture. That was who we thought our audience was going to be. not a big audience, but enough that we could probably make records, and the people who did like us would be enthusiastic.
So what was the MTV generation's reaction?
A mixture of shock and horror, and then a small percentage that liked us and were just amazed and thrilled. And I used to have boxes of letters. Because this is pre-internet, really, when all this happened. The internet was still in its infancy. It was around, but only techies were using it then. The amount of mail we got after the Green Day tour was really illuminating, because you had a lot of kids who were not gay writing to us, but talking about how there was a like queer straight alliance in their high school, and how having a band like Pansy Division coming along really validated that, because it was in the milieu that these kids were existing. It's like, here's the new MTV bands, here's the pop punk stuff, this is alternative, this is underground. It's like, wow, there's a gay band, and they're just like these other bands, and they're singing about this wild stuff, and it's really cool. We got a lot of that, and I'm really happy about that, but it's not who we expected to play music for.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that because of your work in Pansy Division, you've been able to, you know, help gay youth have some identity that wasn't available to them
previously? I'm sorry, you're cutting out.
Okay. Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Okay. Do you think that your work in Pansy Division has helped gay youth, some gay youth come out that maybe previously would have been, you know, felt disassociative with the scene that they were describing?
I think it's helpful, yeah. I mean, I've gotten letters, people saying... some people saying, gosh, you saved my life in high school. And, you know, I don't know if that's really true literally, but I'm glad it helped. I think that it's beneficial to the queer people who are unsure about their sexuality in high school. And some older too. But I do think it had an impact. I can't measure exactly how much, but just from the mail we got, I would say that, yeah, we had being able to insert ourselves into that situation where a band like us normally wouldn't be able to go was pretty amazing.
Well, it definitely had an influence on me, and shortly after the Green Day tour is when you put Pile Up out, which was a collection of singles and B-sides. Uh-huh. With also a handful of covers thrown in as well. And that, I believe, was a very successful record for you.
Yeah, the first three albums all sold about equally. The Undressed, the first one, then the second album was called Deflowered, and then Pile Up.
Mm-hmm.
Then after that, we toured a lot, but because of the massive MTV and Green Day exposure, the other records sold okay, but not as well as those.
Well, after Pile Up, you put out Wish I'd Taken Pictures.
Yeah.
And then you had kind of a lineup change. You had many drummers going in and out of the band over the period of the last 4 years, I guess it was.
Yes.
And then that would be around the time that you acquired Louise and Patrick.
Yes.
Was that both at the same time, I believe, or...?
A few months apart. Mm-hmm. Luis came first. Once we got the drummer situation settled, Luis plays really loud, so he got in our band, and it was kind of like, oh my God, he's drowning us out. We need another guitar player, which we had talked about doing anyway, but we hadn't done anything about it, Chris and I, because we hadn't even been able to settle the drummer situation. So once that got settled, we were able to kind of move on and reinvent ourselves.
Well, and I think that the music did change somewhat at that time. It seems like
going
from pop punk to actually what you now consider as a gay rock band. I feel like there was that was around the time that I feel like that sound evolved more.
Yes, it did open up the sound to more variety.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really what we imagine we could sound like someday, and then we finally did. The other thing about the point when Patrick joined was at a time when we felt that we'd kind of succeeded in doing our initial succeeded at our initial goals, and thought, well, if we're not going to repeat ourselves, if we're not going to become irrelevant, we've got to evolve. And now we've got the people involved with us that'll help us evolve. Change the sound evolves without changing completely.
Sure.
But I thought it was a big step. And so, and that same musical evolution happened right at the time where we thought, all right, people know we're gay now. Even if before we felt like we had to make some reference to it in every song, just like spell it out. And I thought, okay, now people get that we're gay. We don't need to be as blunt and direct all the time. Otherwise, we're just going to bludgeon people, and they'll get tired of it. So though some songs still are openly gay, more are more universal, kind of more like the kind of stuff that that we might have thought, well, we don't want to do that at one point. You know, we might think, well, let's just be as open and direct. And then we thought, no, let's not just keep repeating it. We have to vary the message. And we've been very humorous. And at that point, we thought, no, some people just think that that's all we do. So that's when the songwriting took a more serious-minded turn.
Sure.
But it's always been about trying to maintain a balance, really.
Well, and that was actually my next question, was about whether or not you had consciously made that decision. You said that you had. What were fans' reaction to you, I don't want to say toning it down, but actually broadening your horizons as a songwriter?
You know, I don't think that many people were disappointed. That album came out, Absurd Pop Song Romance was the album, came out in 98, which was a time when pretty much all the bands who were our peers in, you know, on our label and in pop punk and kind of underground indie stuff, that was when sales really started to dive, period, across the board. And so that was true for us, too. So I don't know what things might have been like if the album had come out at a different time, but it really couldn't have come out earlier. We evolved. We didn't just, it would have been cheating the evolution and just go right there and suddenly put out the album that we did when we did that one. The reaction was very good. And a lot of people said, oh, you were kind of overdue to do this. It was a more mature-sounding record, and that can be a bad word for a lot of bands, but I think we rocked harder in some ways on that record and the subsequent ones than some of the early ones. So I don't think it was a matter of just us getting soft.
Well, and you worked with Steve Albini on that record at Electric, correct?
Yeah.
Yeah, and he's produced a lot of my favorite work.
He really helped us make a great record. He's pretty amazing.
What is he? He's a good guy to work with?
He's not going to make your sound harder if that's not what you want. He doesn't have a sound. I mean, his approach is to fulfill the artist's vision. That's why so many people like to work with him. You don't go to him because he has a specific drum sound, though he does have a good one. Or, you know, a certain guitar sound. You go to him because he is really good at fulfilling a band's vision of doing things, and he's got the tools to help you do that.
Well, and it seems like you got more creative on that record sonically as well.
I think so, yeah.
With the arrangements were a little different, and also the just a variety of different sounds. You guys kind of opened yourselves up as opposed to being stuck on your same instrument through the whole record, or you know, there was different bells and whistles throughout. That was nice. So after that, you went on a tour, and then there was quite a delay between Absurd Pop Song Romance and Total Entertainment.
Yeah, the band had toured so much that we were pretty exhausted from touring, and Luis and Patrick especially didn't take to road life as well as Chris and I had, and they missed their friends more than Chris and I did. Also, I had been single the whole time of the 90s, and then Chris had a boyfriend for part of that time. But those guys wanted to stay home a little more, and the fact that we had toured as much as we had the first 2 years that they were in the band, you know, made it so they, yeah, they had a point. We really could have run things into the ground. We were pretty exhausted. So that, and because we weren't touring, then we had to get jobs, which made our availability, less frequent.
Sure.
So it took a while, and we had to, after having worked so hard, 6 albums in 6 years in the 90s, we had thought, okay, well, what do we want to do now? Our big reinvention on Absurd Pop Song Romance wasn't a failure, but it really was an album when we came, and it came out, we thought, this is the record that is going to lift us above our peers, that is going to really boost us. And that didn't happen. So we were kind of left wondering what to do. And that's why it took 5 years for the mm-hmm. next record to come out. Jobs, and then, you know, trying to figure out just what we should be doing. Because it was pretty easy to decide what to do for a long time. It was pretty instinctive. But after you've done a few records, you've really got to figure that out if you want people to continue to be interested in you.
Well, and that next record didn't come out until 2003, but that was Total Entertainment, which was also an awesome record. And once again, I think you guys tried to excel further into the actual production process. There's a lot of detail on that record as well.
That's true, yes.
So we have a new record that's out called That's So Gay.
Indeed.
And is Jello Biafra's song Average Men actually on that record, or is that just for the single?
He does the co-lead vocal on that song. It's a song we recorded, and after we were done recording it, we were still in the studio, and I said to Chris, I said, Jello's going to love this song. And Chris said, hey, we should get him to sing on it. So we did, and he came out, and I had already sung the song, so he came out and sung the song. So then we kind of just put our vocals together, kind of turned it into a duet. And I'm thrilled.
it was very cool. And I'm assuming you guys have probably been friends for a long time, too.
Acquaintances.
I mean, you are on Alternative Tentacles.
Yes.
Excellent. Well, that was great. So now that Pansy Division has been around for over 15 years, how do you feel about the band looking back? Are you happy with your progress? Do you have any regrets?
I don't really have too many regrets. I think about how good we might have sounded on the Green Day tour if we'd had a better drummer and if things were different. I mean, partly the reason we have the people we have in the band now, or have had them, after a certain point, was because we'd gotten somewhat famous and people had heard about us. But I think if we took the band that made Absurd Pop Song Romance and put them out there in front of Green Day's audience, my God, that just would have been even more. I just think our career might have been bigger. But again, that's cheating the chronology. Mm-hmm. That's really about my only regret, that we weren't as good as we later became at the time when we had our maximum exposure.
Well, so you've got an upcoming appearance in Lawrence at the Jackpot on Tuesday, April 28th. Can you kind of give us a preview of what we should expect to see that night?
On some nights on this book tour I'm doing, I do. There are three different things that I can do. I read from my book, and then I'll play. I have my acoustic guitar with me, so I'm doing acoustic versions of Pansy Division songs. And then in some places, I'm showing the Pansy Division documentary film, which came out, which played film festivals last year and just came out on DVD the same time our album did. So at the Jackpot, I'm going to be doing all three, showing the film and performing and reading. So that will be a full night.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. I think it will be awesome. I have already seen the film, however, I caught it in Chicago. Excellent. Well, it has been great chatting with you, John. Is there anything else
you'd like to let
us know before you sign off and enjoy your day in Boston?
I'm going to take a nap.
All right. Sounds good, bud.
I drove 8 hours yesterday, and I'm still tired, so it's going to be a lazy day today.
Well, enjoy your nap, John. Thank you so much for chatting with us.
Thank you.
He's into sports. Looks good in shorts, but you're just another game to him. I've seen his type, seen him all my life. Right!